Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jezza, how dishy would you say Rishi is?
Oh, well, am I ranking him on a scale of 1 to 10?
Whatever scale you feel most comfortable with.
Do you want me to give him like up to 5 stars like a 2009 YouTube video?
I think I most want you to rank him against other prime ministers, how many there are.
Well, he's the hottest prime minister of the modern era. I think that's
Of the ones we have photos for. Actually, yeah. I don't think that's true. I think Anthony Eden is probably the hottest one that have photos for.
Yeah, that is fair. But I think that's probably correct. I don't know. Maybe I think Rishi just pits Eden to the post.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly post-Churchill, Rishi is the dishiest.
Wasn't Anthony Eden post-Churchill?
Yes, he was. And I said, and Rishi is dishier.
Yeah, I'm following.
Yeah.
He's dishier.
Yes. hello, listener. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. Sometimes.
Occasionally, when we can align our schedules appropriately.
We're very busy individuals, Jimmy. And that's for I'm preparing to emigrate and flee the country, and you've got stuff on.
I do, yeah. We've all got stuff on. Very busy at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. What are we going to be talking about this week, Jimmy?
Well, as indicated by my question to Jezza, we're going to be talking about the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who's not that new at this point. He feels very old news a week or so in. Mm-hmm. But given the kerfuffle that his predecessor kicked off, in some ways it's nice that the government doesn't appear to be falling apart every 5 minutes. I mean, it's exciting and it's good content, but kind of bad for the country, I would say.
Yeah, and we didn't really make very much content around the exciting stuff, to be completely honest, did we? I was saying when we were trying to figure out what we were going to talk about this week, it almost feels like a normal episode, doesn't it?
It does.
And as part of this normal episode, we're going to be talking about migration.
That's true. Very good. Move on to the second topic there.
Mm-hmm. What specifically about migration? Come on, Jimmy. Help me out here.
So specifically, we are going to be talking about the furore around the Manston Detention Centre in Kent. Basically, I don't know where this was originally revealed, but it was revealed that the immigration authorities were housing way too many people there, most of them asylum seekers.
It's at about 400% capacity at the moment.
Yeah, so was it about 1,500 people were supposed to be there, and instead 4,000 people were being kept there, and this whole furore blew up over it, and the Home Office has now responded and has reduced the number of people there, but you know, there's still allegations that the conditions there are just totally inappropriate. And it's downstream from the whole arguments around the Channel crossings and UK asylum policy in general, and also the fact that Suella Braverman has been reappointed as Home Secretary.
She's just one of the worst people. I thought Priti Patel was bad.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to get into Jazz's distaste for Suella Braverman.
Cruella Braverman, more like, am I right?
I think somebody actually... Cruella Braverman. There was a cartoon based around that, because you could also go with Suella Deville, which I think
is also very
works
good.
So many opportunities there for 101 Dalmatians based gags.
And then finally, talking about asylum seekers and migration, we're all going to have to migrate our asses off of Twitter, aren't we? Looks like, because Elon Musk bought it of his own free will.
I think initially it was of his own free will, and I think he, you know, he did that thing that men sometimes do where they kind of talk themselves into a situation through bravado and then they end up having to do it.
Hilarious. Joined and then fired half of the employees, but now is having to hire a load of them back, which is quite funny.
I have seen, yeah, I've seen reports that that's happening. There seems to be just a lot of allegations and counter-allegations going on, and people from Twitter talking to the press, and Elon Musk just tweeting something mad. But
and him getting into Twitter fights with Jack Dempsey, who is the one of the founders of Twitter. It's been really fun. Jack Dorsey, not Dempsey, sorry. Yeah, that's been very fun to watch, watching billionaires be bitchy to one another.
Yeah, but we obviously quote quite a lot of stuff from Twitter. It's kind of the centre of journalism, and it, in many ways the centre of British politics, so it does have a big impact on what's going on. But I personally think I'll be fine, Jezza, because, you know, I'm on the right side of free speech, so there's no way I'm going to get kicked off the platform.
Oh, I've
I'm
changed
a bit worried
my,
about you.
Yeah, I've changed my name to Elon Musk and my profile picture to a zoomed-in photo of Elon Musk. So I'm probably going to be banned. So that because I'm apparently impersonating him, because that's a new rule.
One of many new rules. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll be going.
But freedom of speech, Jimmy. Freedom of speech.
I can see this is going to be a fun episode. All right. Why don't we play some music, talk about the Patreon accounts as per usual, and then get on with it.
Oh, Jimmy, I'd love that. Hello friends, Jezza here. We are a podcast supported, no, not by a big corporation, but by other listeners just like you on our Patreon account, where you, for as little as a single dollar per episode, can help us keep this quaint little podcast going. Just want to thank our current patrons, Gemma, Matt, John, Michael, Andrew, Eterna, David, Jer, Nick, Marlene, Seb, Ilona, Theo, Taha, and Nick. You're all really lovely for doing this. Please support us on Patreon. Okay, that's the end of the Patreon read. Music now. Oh, I'm tired.
So, Jezza, how are you feeling about the fact we have another new Prime Minister, the third one this year, in fact?
It's quite fun, isn't it?
Is it fun?
Well, it would have been nice if they'd have not chosen Liz Truss, who then ended up crashing the economy, and then switching to the guy who can actually do the job. That would have been much more preferred if they had been able to, you know, not go through all of that fucking turmoil at the end of the summer. But I don't know. I've always talked about this when they were selecting their new leader. I've always thought about this as there is the person who loses so badly that they get the Tories out. which is I'm going to put my cards out there, listener, and in case this is new information for you, I don't want the Conservatives to be in power any longer. I think they've had quite enough time to fuck everything up, and I'd like anyone else to be in charge. Thank you. I reckon a DUP, SNP alliance, maybe. That would be quite nice to have the home, some of the other home nations in charge, running the government. I think that would be fun.
That seems like quite an unlikely combination, I've got to say.
Well, you can dream, Jimmy. You can dream. I think Rishi Sunak seems like, well, he came into power and then the markets stopped convulsing every minute, which I think broadly is a positive thing. However, I am still worried, it's still a Conservative government. I still think a load of their priorities are wrong. I still think that the way that they've decided to go about things is wrong. We're going into a new austerity in the bottom of a fucking cost of living crisis. I just think everything's really bad still. I'd rather he was steering the ship while things are bad, but I still don't think, I'm not particularly optimistic. How do you feel? Although I do want to sleep with him. How do you feel?
Well, I don't want to sleep with him, so on much. We
at least we have all opinions covered on this podcast, you know?
Yeah, in terms of sexual attraction to Rishi Sunak, mm-hmm. we do have all opinions covered. But I think I largely feel the same as you, to be honest. Liz Truss did seem to have some pretty wacky ideas about how to run things.
Terrible!
I mean, I guess we largely cleaved to the consensus opinion as it became apparent she was going to be chosen as Prime Minister, that this was a bad idea. And, you know, I don't know how you would describe our positions on this podcast. I'm not sure we would fall into the bracket of centre-left exactly, but there was a general consensus around the mushy centre that she was going to do badly, that the Institute of mm-hmm. Economic Affairs ideas that she was championing were going to be bad news generally. I don't think many people, maybe Rishi Sunak would be an exception, predicted that the bond markets and, you know, various other financial industrial things would react the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
She certainly didn't predict that. But yeah, I do feel somewhat reassured, but I share your general outlook that I don't think the Conservatives have my best interests at heart, and therefore it's hard to be as happy
it's,
as
it's
that.
Hard to back him, isn't it? And I almost think that it's a shame, because I do think he's quite, like, he's incredibly rich, incredibly privileged. Is the first brown prime minister that we have had, which is not insignificant and is quite remarkable, especially with the history that the UK has had. I think that that's a really outstanding thing. I'd like to back him, because he seems very competent and seems super smart. However, he is, I think the problem that he has had and the problem that has come up since he has been prime minister is that clearly he's super smart, and clearly the people who understand these things, the people who are running markets and things, have faith in his leadership, at least more than trust, although that was a pretty low rock bottom. However, he is a really inexperienced politician. He's only been in parliament since 2015. And I think some of that greenness shows through with the way that he does politics. A couple of the examples, there's the Suella Braverman appointment. Clearly there was a deal that was done, but that seems to have damaged him quite a lot with his backbenchers, because Suella Braverman seems like an absolute nutter.
Yeah, she's part of the nutty far right within the Tory party, mm-hmm. not the far right generally, although you might dispute that.
Although, yeah, I think the Venn diagram overlaps. And then there was the to-ing and fro-ing of whether or not he was going to go to COP, and then he eventually went. There's also the Gavin Williamson texts that came out over the weekend, where he was using very bad language towards one of the whips.
It wasn't that bad, I don't think.
Well, it was unprofessional.
It was unprofessional, but I think there's a lot of unprofessionalism that goes on in Parliament, which I don't think is a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think that's okay. And those decisions that he's made seems to have clashed somewhat, I think, with the speech that he did when he entered Downing Street, where he said that he wanted to win back people's trust and govern with integrity and all of those kinds of things. So I think that is probably, those are probably the things that are going to keep on cropping up over the next couple of years as we stumble towards a general election.
I mean, on the fact that, we'll discuss his cabinet in a little bit, but on the fact that he is the first non-white prime minister of the UK, as you said, did you see this video?
Do we count Disraeli?
Disraeli was from Central Europe, so he would probably be classed as the first ethnic minority prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, back in the day, people had, I mean, you could still say this is true to some degree, but back in the day, English people did have quite negative attitudes towards Scottish politicians or Anglo-Irish politicians and Welsh politicians as well. So I guess it does somewhat hinge on who you classify as an ethnic minority or not, but, you know, Disraeli being
it's almost being like race is made up.
Well, indeed. Mm-hmm. But Disraeli being a Jewish, although he wasn't a practicing Jew by the time he actually became prime minister, mm-hmm. but being of that background, I think would classify as the first ethnic minority PM. But this, did you
he's
see
also
this
the youngest that we've had for like 200 years or something, right? He's only 42. He's younger than Blair was when Blair came into power.
Yes, I think that's right. Did you see this Trevor Noah video that came out in relation to
I didn't see Rishi the video. I didn't see the video, but I heard people talk about it. Do you want to explain what happens?
So Trevor Noah is a stand-up comedian who now does a talk show in the US, has done that for a while. I think he took over from Jon Stewart.
He's also leaving it. He's in the process of leaving it.
Is he leaving it? Okay. But he did this whole spiel about the alleged backlash towards Rishi Sunak being appointed as Prime Minister as a British Asian man, which... I know it's standard fare for whenever you have national press of one country covering stories from elsewhere, they'll frame it in their own way and they'll relate it to the own issues that are going on in their country. And the British press do that as well. So to some extent, it's fair enough. But it was totally inaccurate. I don't think I've seen any evidence of backlash.
Didn't he use a clip from a caller calling in to LBC or something like that?
I don't, not on the clip I saw. I mean, maybe that was...
That's what I heard. I may be wrong. How did he frame it? What did he say? Because I haven't seen it. What did he say?
Well, he alleged that there was this mass discomfort about Rishi Sunak being an Asian man, being appointed as the Prime Minister of what is still a largely white country. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure if you go onto various Facebook threads or forums or whatever, I'm sure you can find people being racist about him because he's become Prime Minister. I mean, I'm sure you can find people being racist about him beforehand. Mm-hmm. But it's not really reflective of general opinion, I don't think. I think in many ways, him being the first British Asian Prime Minister is quite banal, or is treated as quite a banal fact by most people.
Yeah, British people are not very good at talking about race.
I thought you were going to say feelings there, which would also be true.
Also true. But I don't think we're very good at talking about race, and that inability or lack of desire to engage with race, I think, means that it has just landed as a bit of a moot point. Like, of course, it's been mentioned quite a lot, but I don't think people are uncomfortable about it, simply... And even though we live in like a London bubble, we do have to recognize that. But even some of the most racist people I know do not seem to care.
Well, that's an anecdote, I guess, but probably represents something. I think probably more would have been made of it if he was a Labour Prime Minister, actually, because I think that some of it is that the kind of people who talk about diverse representation of ethnic minorities or women or what have you, they tend to be on the left, broadly speaking. I mean, it is something that Tories do talk about,
but all of the women and now the first brown prime minister are all Conservatives. What does that say about Labour? Very interesting.
I mean, partly it is a function of the Tories just winning more elections and going through more prime ministers
and going
in
more,
a short space of time.
If you have three prime ministers in a year, in a period of like 4 months, then there's more chance, I guess.
Yeah, and I think I've not looked at the numbers of this directly, but I have a sense that Labour hangs onto its leaders for longer. So the churn the churn in general, I think, is important. But yeah, I think more would have been made of it. There's a bit of a shrug that comes with the fact that Liz Truss was the third female prime minister, I don't think was mentioned at all, really. I mean, that's obviously just a statement of fact, but...
Theresa May mentioned it in Liz Truss's first of two prime minister questions.
Right, okay. I don't think it was widely focused on, though.
No, not really. Well, when you get to three, that's a hat trick, isn't it? And then it's a rule.
Yeah. We should probably talk about the cabinet, though, a little bit. Since you mentioned Suella Braverman being reappointed as Home Secretary after, was it 6 days out of office or something like that?
Yeah, if that.
So she was fired ostensibly for having accessed confidential data through a private email account or something
that. She forwarded a classified document to her private email address and then forwarded those documents onto somebody who did not have clearance to see those documents.
Yeah, so kind of just basic security incompetence, I think it's fair to say, which given the remit of the Home Office.
That's not incompetence. That's deliberate. That's trying to bypass, like, a system that is... So apparently, I've heard, apparently what happens when you try to send it to somebody who doesn't have the classification clearance, a pop-up comes up on your email and says, this person doesn't have access to it. But she sent it to her private email so that then she'd be able to send it out to that person. Is what, allegedly, is what sounds like allegedly happened. Please don't sue me, Suella Braverman.
I mean, I think plenty of people say worse things about her at the moment. But I mean, I think the security thing, you know, it should probably disqualify her from office. And he's clearly appointed her partly as a, in terms of appeasing a certain wing of the Tory party, as you said.
Well, but she backed him on the Sunday before the deadline for nominations, for pledges to who they were going to back for the to be the next prime minister. So she supported Rishi Sunak, and it feels so obvious that there was a deal that was done.
Yeah, right? there's been allegations of a deal, and they do seem pretty plausible as it goes.
Because it doesn't seem to me that Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak are particularly natural bedfellows.
Well, he's a kind of cosmopolitan, metropolitan. I mean, he's socially, I guess he's probably quite liberal. Economically, he's probably more conservative, but...
I don't know if he's socially very liberal.
Do you not think so?
Well, he's trying to do some nasty things about the Gender Recognition Act of 2010, but let's go on. Let's not turn this into another trans debate, Jimmy, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, part of the, you know, those kind of policies, though, are about, you know, it's about appeasing that, again, that wing of the Tory party, right? Well, yeah. So that may or may not be reflective of his personal views, I don't think. I think you're right. I think they're not natural bedfellows at all. But she's been the most prominent appointment. So I guess it's because a lot of progressives really don't like her for reasons that we'll come on to in the second segment.
I was really surprised how continuity the cabinet was.
I was about to say that, yeah.
From specifically Liz Truss's time. So...
well, also somewhat from Boris Johnson's time in office as well.
Yeah. So there's Jeremy Hunt and James Cleverly both continued in their roles as Chancellor and Foreign Secretary, which I was really surprised by. A lot of people expected Penny Mordaunt to end up being given one of the big offices, so the Foreign Office. But no, Cleverly is staying in there. Then Govey is back. Dominic Raab is back. Ben Wallace is staying as defence, which I don't think anybody is particularly surprised by. It's all of the same. Kemi Badenoch. Theresa Coffey.
Theresa Coffey was moved, though. She was Health Secretary, and now she's
Environment, Food
Secretary.
And Rural Affairs. Yeah. So I guess has direct... ability to, I don't know, source the tobacco for her cigars. I don't know. but yeah, it doesn't seem like... And this is me thinking aloud. Do you think that is because he's only been in Parliament for 7 years? I feel like there's not... Who are his allies? The reason that he ended up going so high... up the ranking so quickly was because Dominic Raab took a shining to him because they campaigned together on Vote Leave, and then because Boris Johnson appointed him Chancellor just before the pandemic to replace Sajid Javid. I feel like Rishi Sunak doesn't have a deep network of allies in the Conservative Party. Although I am just saying this from like an outsider, I don't know anything behind the scenes. But the appointments in this cabinet suggest that to me.
I think so. I mean, I think there's a certain extent to which, almost in parallel with what happened with Boris Johnson in 2019, is that the Tories are electorally in a serious bind at the moment, or they certainly were coming out of Liz Truss's premiership, and I would say that's still true, largely, although their polling has recovered a little bit. And I think a lot of them are just looking for somebody who gives them the best possible chance of, I don't think in this case, winning the general election, but stemming some of the damage that is, I think, inevitably going to happen at this point. So with Boris Johnson, in a lot of profiles of him, you'd hear you'd hear or read journalists saying that he wasn't very clubbable, that he didn't have a strong network among Tory MPs. And a lot of people chose him as a kind of Hail Mary move in 2019. The Tories looked to be in a bad place and they chose an outlandish candidate who was able to turn things around and win them the general election. In this case, I think they've picked somebody who is seen as relatively sensible. I mean, I think even among people like us who are not well disposed to the Tories, he's seen as a relatively sensible guy. And I think there's probably an assumption out there, I don't know if this has been, I assume this has been focus grouped actually, that he gives that impression off to people generally. He's not seen as crazy or wacky. He's not really seen as massively charismatic either, but in some ways that actually adds a certain solidity to his image, I think, that he won't do anything rash.
The Conservatives are recovering back up in the polls, still way behind Labour. So most recent polling has them at just under 30%, which is crazy for us to say that that's a recovery. At the moment, Labour would still win a majority at a
election. Is that a 20-point difference at the moment, then, according to the one you're looking at?
It is. It looks at about 20 points, yeah.
20 points,
which is better than 30 points, which is what it was at the end of Liz Truss's term.
Yes, yeah. I mean, replacing her has definitely been a good move for the Tories electorally, if nothing else. And, you know, to your point about the continuity in the cabinet, a lot of that is also, I think, about balancing various factions. You know, the fact that he's got some people who are in Boris Johnson's cabinet, some people who are in Liz Truss's cabinet, you know, the Suella Braverman representing the more extreme right of the party in various ways. I think the next 2 years are going to be about survival for the Tory party, and trying to get as good a result as they can, with the caveat that I think probably a lot of them accepted that it's very unlikely they're going to win the general election. You know, Rishi Sunak will probably not be prime minister after
there were some polls under Liz Truss that had the Conservatives projected only 20 seats, and that would have really been an absolute wipeout for them to be, I think, the fourth party.
Yeah, behind the Lib Dems and the SNP. Yeah. By those numbers, which I think at the time everyone was like, "There's, you know, this is a backlash to Liz Truss in particular and the mini budgets." So I think very few people expected those numbers to hold. Probably, you know, even if Liz Truss had stayed in office, those numbers wouldn't have held as an actual general election, because a lot of people don't like Labour. You know, in the same way a lot of people don't like the Tories, there's a hardcore of voters on either side who will just vote for the other party because, you know, the other biggest party will vote against the party they don't like.
Do you think he has a chance of winning back more in the 2 years that we have? Bearing in mind that the Bank of England said that we were looking at about 2 years of recession ahead of us. Do you think that he has a chance of recovering more points?
I think he could potentially reduce the gap between Labour and the Tories, but I honestly would say I think a Labour win at the next general election is, if not 100% inevitable, then like 95%. I just don't think they're going to recover the gap.
Official pollster Jimmy Nicholls says.
I'm more just putting a number on how I feel about things, but I'd imagine if you go back and look at precedent of sitting governments, we've got about, what, 20-odd years of, or 25 years, I think 97 modern polling is, that's the date usually given for modern polling starting. And I don't think there's ever been any sitting government that's recovered a poll gap like that. I mean, if you go back and look at Tony Blair's time in office, there's times where the government polls better after a period of being lower, but the general trajectory is down overall over the long term. And as you say, the Tories have been in power for 12 years now, and
it's so long.
Yeah. So that's my feelings about things. Do you think that Rishi Sunak might turn it around, might win a full term in office at the next general election?
I think he is the Conservatives' only chance of achieving that. But I still think it's a really, really long shot. I think so much damage has been done by the last two prime ministers in terms of distrust of that party. That what I worry about is how many people are just going to completely disengage from politics and just not turn out to vote because of what they've seen in Westminster for the past 2 or 3 years since Boris Johnson came into power. Like the embarrassing, like flagrant abuse of, like disregard for the rules and the incompetence of Liz Truss. And now we're going to see a huge number of public sector cuts for like in order for them to be able to balance the books in the budget that's meant to be coming out next week. I just worry that there's so much damage that has been done that people are just going to completely disengage from the process.
I mean, it's possible that voter turnout will be lower at the next general election compared to what it was in 2019. I think a lot of people are going to engage are going to be people who would generally vote for the Tories, don't really want to vote for anyone else, but don't want to vote for the Conservative Party as it currently is. Mm-hmm. I think that some people that, you know, have already declared their decision to disengage are far left wingers and Corbynites who really don't mm-hmm. like what the Labour Party has become because it is tacked to the centre, and therefore will either vote Green or for another smaller party, or won't vote at all.
That would be nice if we get some more Green MPs. I think that would be lovely in Parliament. A little splattering.
I don't know. I do feel, I mean, I voted for the Greens at last general election, but they have their own nutters, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, but Carolyn Lucas is nice, isn't she?
She is, but I can't vote for her in my South London
constituency. Just move to Brighton. Brighton and Hove, mate. Where it's at.
I think I'd have to move to a specific area of Brighton, which is not very affordable for me.
Yeah, probably not.
So, shall those are my problems, on? Though. Yeah, we should probably move on.
Yeah. So, we have, over the last few weeks, seen a huge hubbub happen at the, what's it called?
Manston Processing Centre.
The Manston Processing Centre, which is not a detention camp, Jimmy, as you called it earlier.
I think it is called a detention centre. I think that is because people are detained there, not in a, you know, you're about to go to jail sense, but people are kept there while they're migration.
Great.
Being processed for migration.
I love the language that we use around people who are asylum seekers in this country. It's really fantastic. Just to, before you jump down my neck, Jimmy, everybody calls them migrants. Something over 90% of the people who come over to the UK in small boats apply for some sort of asylum. Now, do they all through the whole process? No, they don't, especially from particular demographics. But these are asylum seekers.
And asylum seeker is a type of migrant, therefore migrant is correct.
Yes, it is correct, but I feel
it's probably the most correct way to talk about them, because as you say, a very high proportion do apply for asylum, a smaller proportion get an acceptance on the first round or accepted on appeal.
But do you not feel like the tone around the word migrant has now become really dehumanized?
I don't feel that way. I mean, there's no other word for. I mean, you're going to be a migrant when you move to America.
Is anybody going to call me that? People are going to call me expats. Why don't we call them expats?
Do Americans say expats? I think that's more of a British thing, isn't it?
I can guarantee that not a single American is going to call me a migrant.
I mean, you are.
Technically, I am, or immigrant.
Yeah.
But I have an aversion to the word migrant because of the way that it is used and the way that it is and who uses it, I think probably more than anything, makes it feel like it is used as a way to dehumanize these people. Like seeing like bylines of photos or the text underneath photos saying migrants changing, blah blah blah, just say people. I know that this is me being fluffy.
Often in these cases, the fact that they're a migrant is what the story's about. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but I have feelings.
I think there was a, I don't remember which newspaper this was published in, but there was a, or even if it was a newspaper, it might have just been CNN or something, but there was an American media company that published an article about illegal immigrants, although because it was a left-leaning publication, it would have said undocumented migrants, but it chose not to use any of those terms, like illegal immigrant or undocumented migrant. And the way the article was written, it became impossible to understand what was really being discussed because they'd avoided any of the words that would clue you in and explain what the story was about. So I do get your point about migrant, depending on how it's said and the context in which it's said and who's saying it, as you say, it can have negative connotations. It's not complete without baggage, but there's no replacement for it as a word, I don't think, because it does describe somebody who's moved across. It doesn't actually make any presuppositions about their migration status as such. Like, they could be an illegal immigrant, they could be an asylum seeker, they could be an economic migrant as well. They could have legal permission to be coming over. So it's not an entirely neutral word, but it's the most neutral word, I think, in this scenario. And I think
the reason that I don't like it is because it takes away the urgency of the amount of people, the overwhelmingly large number of people who are asylum seekers, and the, and migrant feels very deliberately, it feels like it trivializes and flattens that experience, where the majority of people are fleeing some kind of persecution and are looking for refuge in the UK. And by saying migrant, it means that I can be clumped into that. And it is quite ridiculous that I can be called the same word as the people who are fleeing war and persecution. Does that make sense?
I guess so, but you could say similar things to, I mean, anybody who works for a living can be described as a worker, but somebody who works for a law firm for 600 grand a year and has properties in multiple countries and so on and so on, is there a different kind of worker from somebody who's cleaning out toilets for minimum wage with very few labour protections in place?
You see what I mean? Yeah, 100%. But I feel like you would have to clarify those differences. And this doesn't, this uses the word worker as a way to talk about people who are doing the equivalent in your example of like manual labor.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, all language aside, what do we make of
this? Oh, this wouldn't be a Right Dishonorable podcast if we didn't talk about semantics.
I spent my entire recent newsletter bitching about how often people talk about semantics, and we do it a lot in this podcast, which I guess makes me a hypocrite, but I have to protest a little bit, I guess.
Oh, Jimmy, you love it so much, you know. I don't really know how to approach this story. I think there's the one side of the failed policy, but the continued rhetoric of the Conservative Party who are in power and who are in government. So we have them persistently saying that they need, that they are going to, like, we're the only ones with a plan. They've had a plan and they've been in a position to implement their plan for the last 12 years and things are getting worse. Now, is it 100% their fault that the more and more people are choosing to come over in small boats? No, but the fact that we don't have the infrastructure or the public funding for the organizations that end up being the point of first contact for these people is clearly a huge problem when you have facilities like Manston overspilling and being like, people have said that there's worries about well, this is the Mail, so who knows, but apparently there are reports of diphtheria and cholera in the center, although I don't have confirmations of that because you can't trust the Mail.
I've read that in other newspapers, although whether they picked that up from the Mail themselves and then just repeated it unattributed, I don't know, but yeah,
who knows?
I've read similar things,
but literally also people be like leaving the facility and wandering around local communities, that also can't be an easy thing for local communities, let alone for the people who are doing the wandering around.
And some of them were sent on a train to Victoria, is that right? Right, is this a different group that I'm thinking about?
No, I think this is the same group. There were also some that were put on a coach to Norwich. So this is how they're dealing with it. They're moving the people in this detention centre around to places where there is more capacity to deal with them. And generally they're being moved into intended for short accommodation hotels, is what I understand, right?
Yes, they are doing various things like that. And they, the Home Office says they have reduced the numbers from the 4,000 it was when this whole crisis broke out, basically. I mean, I'm more sceptical about migration than you are, I think, in general. And I actually think this is 100% the Tories' fault. I mean, not, you know, notwithstanding.
Oh my God.
notwithstanding that, you know, obviously it's not a British government's fault that some of these other countries are collapsing, although in some instances the British government has contributed to that process. And, you know, there's various push factors from other countries that you can't expect to control. But in terms of how the asylum seeking has been mishandled.
The things I'm thinking of is like, we've seen a huge increase in Albanian migrants. The UK has not contributed to the what has happened in Albania, for example.
Yeah, that is true. Right, that's kind of what I'm saying. There's certain instances, those push factors, which the British government's not in control of. But you know, a major factor behind all this, as far as I can make out, is that to claim asylum in the UK, you have to go to the UK. But you can't get to the UK without some sort of visa. So, you know, it's a Kafkaesque system of that there's no way through the bureaucracy without breaking the law in some way. And that certainly has played a part in incentivizing channel crossings, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we also, they constantly talk about the safe and legal routes. The BBC has a little bit about this. There are currently, according to the BBC, 9 safe and legal routes open to asylum seekers. There are some that are specific to particular countries, so for Afghanistan, Hong Kong, and Ukraine. And then there's the UK settlement scheme, which has only existed since 2021 and has only settled just over 1,000 refugees. The community sponsorship scheme, where local communities can say, oh, we will take some asylum seekers, which in 2021 took 144 people. The Family Refugee Reunion Program, which has several thousand, which is providing reunions for parents and children who are in the UK with their relatives outside of the UK. So that's about 6,000 visas were granted in 2021. And then the resettlement scheme, which has existed since 1995, and last year only 2 people were settled that way. And there are tens of thousands of people coming across on boats alone. There have been tens of thousands.
It's 40,000 this year so far.
So 40,000 people up until this point. And I can tell you that all of those numbers of refugees that have been able to be settled in the safe and legal processes is not enough to deal with those numbers that are coming here and trying to plug into our systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but I mean, personally, I do think there should be a numerical limit on the number of asylum seekers the UK takes. From what I could make out, the UK doesn't take proportionally as much as France or Germany does, and I guess part of the reason is that they you know, the UK is a series of islands, and that represents that is a physical barrier to people actually arriving. But it is also due to Tory policy, right? They've deliberately decided to make it very difficult for people, for asylum seekers, to come over here. And I suppose it's about getting that balance between having a system that actually works for the people who need to use it, versus actually imposing a limit and actually being able to enforce that limit by removing people from the country who don't have a right to be here. And it appears to be the, you know, whatever your view of what the right number should be and what, you know, what whatever your view of the Conservatives generally, in this policy area they're totally failing. Like and they've been in power for 12 years, so it's not a case if they're just getting to grips with something that has suddenly sprung upon them, because we've been talking about channel crossings for years as well. So
I remember 2016 was kind of like a huge, was the first year I remember it being kind of like a zeitgeist touch point over the summer of 2016.
Well, that was all to do with Mediterranean crossings originally, and that was when David Cameron was actually criticised for using the word swarm in relation to people migrating.
Oh, and now Suella Braverman openly uses invasion on our southern coast, and it's just so dehumanizing and unhelpful. Like, it's just rhetoric. It does nothing. It makes situations worse. And it ruins our ability to be able to work with partners who might be able to actually help us to, over the long term, because this is going to take a long time to sort out, long term be able to create safer routes for people to be able to apply for asylum, or make sure that these places don't have such push factors as they do. It's so short-sighted.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the argument is that if you make those safer routes available, it will incentivize people claiming asylum because, you know, in general terms, the harder you make a process, the less inclined people are going to be to use that process. And the easier you make it, the more people will use that process, which mm-hmm. I guess it must have some validity, right? But I mean, what they're doing here is they've created a humanitarian crisis right on our doorstep by, you know, leading all these people to cross the channel. And I do get the argument that these people are moving from France, which is a safer country as the UK and as developed a country as the UK.
Oh, I don't know, Jimmy. They eat snails.
Among other things, yeah. But I don't, you know, obviously these people aren't fleeing France and they have to get to France in order to get on boats and cross mm-hmm. to the UK. But I think that argument is undermined by the wider point that Britain does say that it wants to participate in international asylum regimes, and there's a general sense that we should take our fair share, whatever that number would be. I know you can argue over that. But I think just as a generally civilized country, you should just have a asylum system that works, that does actually let the people in who you want to let come in and stops people coming in that you don't want to come in for whatever mm-hmm. reason, And yeah, it just makes us look very uncivilized and incompetent as well, apart from anything else. So it's a total disaster of a policy area, mm-hmm. to repeat myself.
Excellent. I'm glad you're on the same page. You also wanted to talk about some of the census data that came out.
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of the backdrop to, the argument about asylum seekers and people crossing the channel is obviously it taps into a wider argument about how much migration is the right amount of migration. And we had the census last year, mm-hmm. I think it was March 2021. And basically these numbers came out, and this is the data for England and Wales. And now 16.8% of the people living in England and Wales were born overseas, which is higher than it was in 2011 when it was 13.4%. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, because the population's increased, it's also a larger absolute number. But I suppose, you know, part of the reason that people are hostile about the asylum thing is that there is a general sense that migration levels are out of control, although, interestingly, attitudes to migration have softened since the Brexit referendum took place. And certainly there's people who argue that it's because people do have a sense that Britain does have control of its migration again, because we're no mm-hmm. longer part of the single market with the freedom to move rules that entails. Migration is still exceedingly high. I think it actually hit record levels the last time they brought out stats for this post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. More migration is increasingly coming from outside of the EU than, you know, compared to within the EU. And that is partly a function of government policy, and also, as I said, the fact freedom of movement no longer applies for the UK in relation to the EU. I think the numbers are just numbers. Are you sort of morally neutral about whether a higher percentage of people born abroad is a good or bad thing? Do you think it doesn't matter at all, or, you know?
I couldn't care less. Like I have lived in places in the UK where I am like an ethnic minority, like where the white population is the minority. I used to live in I still live in Newham, and Newham is majority not white. I couldn't care less.
But the racial thing's different from being born overseas.
Presumably
a majority of the population in Newham were born in the UK, I would guess, or, you know, it's...
I would assume so, although... what was it for London? There's a really high stat for the... I think it's something like 40% of adults in London aren't born in the UK.
That might be right. Certainly,
yeah.
London
in the UK, more than 40% of London's residents were not born in the UK. So it wouldn't surprise me if Newham, as a borough, didn't have.
Yeah, it could be. It could be individual boroughs. Yeah.
I just do not think it matters. UK has always been a place for people to come.
I mean, in a very general sense, yes. Sort
yeah.
Mass migration is a recent phenomenon. It's a phenomenon from the post-Second World War.
Why should I care?
I think it matters in terms of the cohesiveness of a country, but I think the numbers in and of themselves,
Newham,
I'm not sure.
Newham is pretty cohesive? Cohesive?
I don't know Newham, so you're probably right. I think it's what I mean by that is that I think that the thing that actually worries me about migration is the existence of the phrase often uses. I think it's like people leading parallel lives or parallel communities where, and actually there's this book by Paul Collier, who's a migration academic, where he talks about the. He tries to calculate a number basically by which there's a tipping point where if you get levels of migration higher than that tipping point, you get sort of diaspora communities forming and you get less integration with the sort of native population in a, mm-hmm. you know, I don't mean that in a racial sense, but the people who already live there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's kind of unhealthy in various ways. I mean, the argument around, this was some months ago, the teacher in Batley and Spen who was hounded out of his job for showing cartoons of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Stuff like that can happen, and I think there's things like that I don't think are a good thing. And I think that having lower levels of migration in instances like that makes things like that less likely to happen. So I actually think for me it's more about the composition, like actually having people from a wider range of origin countries, I think is probably a good thing, because I think it probably encourages integration better than if you get large numbers from individual countries.
This is the thing I think you end up with especially the initial people who move here, they will they'll bring a lot of their own cultures and they'll maybe have, like you said, like a parallel life to kind of like the British way of life. But then their kids are all going to go to school together.
Yes, although actually there was that, I know where you're going with this. You're basically saying that, you know, once all the kids go to school together, they all muck in and a new culture forms. But in certain instances, there was polling a few years ago, which was about kind of second generation immigrants to Britain from mm-hmm. Muslim countries, and the second generation, i.e. the kids, people who've been born in this country and spent mm-hmm. their whole lives here, for instance, have more severe attitudes about homosexuality than their parents did. So mm-hmm. it doesn't always work out that way, and I think part of the reason it doesn't always work out that way is because you have such large groups of people that there's no need for interaction with different parts of the population.
Divide and conquer them.
Divide and conquer. You're going back to the invaders rhetoric of Suella Braverman.
Yeah, exactly. She is my inner voice.
Yeah, I mean, I also think, absolute numbers of migrants do matter in terms of planning public services and that sort of thing, which obviously the Tories aren't that interested in anyway. But
no, of course.
Yeah, the numbers do mean something in and of themselves, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I also just think they're kind of interesting, mm-hmm. is all.
Yeah, so. Twice as many Italians in the UK as there were 10 years ago. That's my favourite fact. So, are you going to get a master's on account?
Is this in relation to my what I've just said about migration? Or are you just trying to make a segue into the Twitter
that was
topic?
Me. It wasn't a segue. That was a cut and pivot.
Cut and pivot. No, I mean, what even is Mastodon? I only heard about it this week.
I don't really know. I feel like it's social media on the blockchain, but nobody wants to call it that. I have a friend who accidentally joined a furry's Mastodon network.
So there's little sub-forums then and sub-groups that you can join.
I don't know anything about Mastodon, but apparently that's where everybody's going. Guys,
they tried to introduce
right there.
They tried to introduce Twitter networks or something a few weeks ago.
Twitter, oh.
Is it networks? Is that what it's called? Where you can add people to a group. I don't know if it's still going, actually, if they've already abandoned that feature because the person who was in charge of it has been fired.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, I was about to say Donald Trump. Elon Musk has bought Twitter.
He for came $44 in with... billion. Dollars.
It's too much money.
Which even he says was too much money, but he was, as we alluded to in the introduction to this podcast, he was kind of
strong-armed
into it.
Yeah.
He tried to back out, but he was legally obliged to, I guess, because he tried to weasel out of it, and Twitter said, we're calling our lawyers, and then he had to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess he was in the wrong in that.
What an idiot. Like, I can't believe that people think he's a literal god. But he ended up deciding to fire half of the staff, which actually was a really sad day for me because I work in tech. And so all of the tweets of people saying, I've had a wonderful time, this was such a great group of people to work with. Like the ethics team saying that they had really tried to make stuff better. The people on the policy team who were trying to make Twitter like compliant, they're all gone. And I felt for them a little bit for my sins.
Did you know anyone personally who...
No, I know fired? I know people personally who used to work at Twitter, but nobody who works there now.
Right. I don't feel that sorry
people
for
people I followed on Twitter were fired, and so I felt sorry for them.
I mean, they're exceedingly employable. Having Twitter on your CV for some length of time, you'll probably be okay, I'd have thought. Like, you know, it's not a load of coal miners being fired and seeing the prospect of never working again because
no,
they don't
they're
have
probably
any,
really
any
rich.
Transferable skills.
Although part of their compensation is Twitter stock, which I don't think is going to be doing particularly well.
I suppose so, but isn't that the whole thing? Is that he had to buy out all of the public stock in order to own the company? Is it still a public company? I should have googled this before the podcast, but
I don't think so. But you still, their comp will still include shares in the company.
Yes, but if he's bought out their shares, they might have.
Oh.
I don't, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying.
I'm just gonna.
Oh God,
I'm gonna
I have
just...
no idea. But apparently, there are some people, sources from Bloomberg and TechCrunch have said that some people are being asked to return after they were laid off as soon as one day after they were laid off because they were laid off by mistake. So we don't really have an idea of who the people were who were being asked back, what departments they were from. But from the looks of it, it was a lot of the stuff that helped Twitter to maintain its position as a law-abiding platform.
Before you go any further, Twitter is being delisted from the New York Stock Exchange and its shares will no longer be... Yeah, so as his $44 billion, that's buying people out of their shares and making the company private again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, as you were saying, yeah, a lot of the sackings that he's made do seem to be about compliance and content moderation, although there allegedly is still the core content moderation team has not been fired.
They desperately need it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
what do you make of it? Do you think this changes anything? Are you gonna keep on saying that you've quit Twitter and then coming back to it every couple of months?
I have stopped saying that because I do accept I'm addicted and you know I'm using it every day, but I'm not that bothered. I mean, even if it shut down, I'm sure I would get cravings, but I wouldn't be able to. It would be like, you know, if you're a smoker and they ban the sale of cigarettes and you can't be bothered to go get them illegally, you're like, well, I just can't get that anymore. Part of the problem with Twitter is how available it is. It can just be brought up on your phone or computer in an instant. So if that was no longer a
stuff.
Thing, it would probably be in some ways be good for me. I mean,
So you're here waiting for Twitter to crumble to the ground.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I still think it's quite an enjoyable place. I find interesting articles there. There's interesting people who tweet mm-hmm. about topics I'm interested in. I mean,
you're so nice about me.
I think I'll get enough from you from doing this podcast. So I don't think I necessarily. I mean, and you're impersonating Elon Musk now, so you've already left
that.
Twitter.
Yeah. So there was this guy who is Twitter verified, who changed his name to Elon Musk, and then started tweeting about like drinking his own piss.
Yes, I think I did see this. But his Twitter handle was still what it was before.
Yeah. He just changed, like, he's done the same thing that I did. So changed the text and then put a really unflattering photo of Elon Musk as his icon. And then the account got banned. And then Elon Musk said, or tweeted, he didn't say anything. He tweeted, from now on, if you're a parody account imitating a real person and you don't mark yourself as a parody account, then... that goes against our policies. Okay, thanks, bye. Freedom of speech.
I'm sure that I would imagine that has been Twitter policy for a while now. Like, most of the parody accounts I see are marked as parody accounts. It says it in the bio. Usually.
But this person was so clearly a parody account.
Yeah. I think it's usually obvious from context whether they're a parody account or not. But part of... Yeah, go on.
No, I just love that Elon comes in and goes, freedom of speech, this is going to be the place where everybody can say what they want, and it's freedom of speech, everybody, and then he bans a guy who's taking the piss out of him.
I guess so. I mean, I think because it comes with this whole thing of...
I just want to see if I get banned now, because I've also changed my...
You're probably not important enough, I'm afraid, Jazza. But I can go and report you to the Twitter authority.
Oh, can you? That would get me so many new followers.
Okay, I mean, not if you're banned from... You might just get banned by an automated process.
That was meant to be a joke. Oh,
I see.
Funny, yeah.
I don't think you've got a future as a cancelled podcaster, Jazza, I'm afraid.
No? Oh, that's a shame.
Cancelled by Elon Musk. Hashtag.
It's like former Google employee, cancelled by Elon Musk.
You could write a book on the basis of that, I think. I don't
or at least
tell,
have a very successful LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's the fact that the parody thing is obviously related to the fact that he's planning on charging people for verified status, which is a little blue ticket.
Charging $8 a month.
Yeah, $8. Mm. I mean, it was initially $20 a month, wasn't it? And he then lowered it, tweeting at Stephen King. Or something like that, something ridiculous. Like, he's just making up the pricing on the fly. And, I mean, that seems bad. I mean, the verification feature is a good feature. It obviously...
Yeah, because it determines who's who. It determines who's the authentic Jazza John, for example.
Yeah, if you're a public figure or a company or whatever, and you see that they've tweeted something and you can immediately see that they're a verified account and they are the organisation they claim to be, that's obviously a good thing. It just in terms of usability, forget the arguments about misinformation and you know, the health of public discourse and all that high-minded stuff. That is just good from a user perspective. And I mean, people have very strong opinions about Elon Musk in general, and they are using this as a chance to just slag him off as a person.
Which is fun.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's fun. But at the end of the day, he's also a guy who used to run a payments company, still does run a car company, runs a whole boring company, is he still involved in SpaceX? Runs SpaceX. He's not a guy who knows dick about social media other than the fact that he uses it, which, you know, I mean, I drink a lot of beer, that doesn't necessarily know. I mean, I know how to brew beer, right? So he's making a lot of bad decisions because he is inexperienced at the thing he's trying to do. Because
he wants to turn it into a WeChat app, apparently. So in every app where you do payments, you do like Google search and all of those kinds of things. But
isn't that what everyone's... I mean, not everyone. There's a lot of people out there who want to like add a payments function to whatever app it is that they're pushing mm-hmm. out. So... And I guess you could say one of the things about social media is a lot of them are emulating features on other social media platforms. I realize we're straying very close to your employment here, Jazza, so you won't be able to comment, but like the YouTube thing where you have YouTube shorts, which are more similar to the short videos you get on other social media platforms, and there is a sense that they are coming together and overlapping more rather than having unique propositions that make them well suited for certain things, like the fact that Instagram is more video oriented than it used to be would be another example.
What an interesting insight into YouTube's products and or services, Jimmy, that you have expressed yourself.
I mean the whole free speech thing, I do think that Elon Musk has more appetite for offensive speech than his average progressive critic, who may or may not be a journalist. You know, obviously that is actually a tension there, and people here, you know, even yourself to some degree, who are attacking him for being anti-free speech in the way that he actually deals with insults about himself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, there's an element of hypocrisy there, but I do think in general, a Twitter with Elon Musk at the helm is going to be less twitchy about people discussing contentious topics like, you know, trans rights or racial issues or whatever than, you know, I mean, then even if Jeff Bezos owned it, for that matter, and he's, you know, hardly the most progressive guy ever. So to that degree, you know, I do think it's a good thing, but I also think that he clearly doesn't know what he's doing in other respects. So,
do you think he's going to unban Donald Trump?
I think Donald Trump has expressed that he's not interested in coming back to Twitter. That might just be rubbish.
Yeah, that's rubbish.
So about the unbanning of previously banned Twitter accounts, the most prominent of which is Donald Trump's, Elon Musk has said that they're currently reviewing what the process for that would look like. So I think it's quite likely Donald Trump's going to be back on Twitter before too long.
How joyful.
It will be quite entertaining in a way.
Mm-hmm. What will it take for you to leave?
If I get bored of it, I think.
I love how you can't. What if you get harassed and abused?
I just have excellent opinions, so I never get any harassment. That would be my advice to people getting harassed: is just improve your opinions.
Ladies and gentlemen, the white straight man.
I also think, to some degree, on the white straight man accusation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually think this. I'd say this of you to an extent: is that men are probably just less bothered about being insulted on Twitter than other people are. Like certain people care less.
Yeah, that, Jimmy, is what privilege is.
I don't think it's... I don't mean this in a privileged sense. I just mean it's a dispositional sense, is that some
people
have...
No, but your ability to be able to take that kind of stuff on the chin comes from the fact that we move through the world in a state of elevated privilege than people who are from racial minorities and who are women or non-binary or trans. Like, when somebody insults us on Twitter, it is very unlikely, we can't envision there being somebody showing up at our door to physically harm us. Whereas if you're a trans woman and someone insults you on Twitter, that is a very real possibility of somebody turning up. Or there is more of a perception and more possibility. There's the perceived higher possibility of somebody showing up on your door and actually dealing you real harm.
I guess so, but I'm talking about more on a fundamental level. Males have more conflict appetite, so I think that's why, you know, certain like men give less of a shit, frankly. And I think that Elon Musk is, personality wise, yeah, I get what you're saying about him being hypocritical on this point, but he's got a horrendous conflict appetite. Clearly, I think on some level he doesn't really care, and I think that's why he doesn't see. That's why he takes the stance he does on free speech, at least in terms of what he publicly says about it. And I think part of this tussle about Twitter is, it's not really about, I mean, it is about politics, but it's about people's different dispositions in terms of conflict and insults and the way they want public discourse to be.
Yeah, and what they want and expect from the social media sites where they hang out.
Yeah, so, you know, there is an argument that some sites should be a bit more hostile and a bit more conflicted, and there should be some services that are a bit more nice and fluffy, I would say.
I love that. Shall we wrap up?
Yeah, I think that was chaotic. As chaotic as Twitter, appropriately enough. You can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols, but nobody's going to send me any backlash because, as previously said, I have excellent opinions. So,
And you can find me hiding under my bed.
Well, that is just asking for it, Jezza. I don't want to victim blame, but you have literally invited them to come and find you.
Exactly. All right. Toodle, everyone.
Bye-bye.